This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 30th of October, 1953. The title of this lecture is The Particle with Regard to Time. This tape is 83 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions. Please note, this tape ends abruptly as did the original master recording.
Okay. This first morning lecture of October the 30th, and this bright morning, I would like to just start right in fairly low gear with you and have you pick out several points behind you and on above you and on either side of you and in front of you. Just several points. And now as we go through this little process, I simply want you to put each one of these I give you in a new point. Each time, remember, a new point. All right? There's not supposed to be action there. Put that at one of the points. At another point, there's not supposed to be action there. Another point, there's not supposed to be action there. Another point, there's not supposed to be anything there. At another point, there's no action there. Another point, there never will be any action there. Another point, there never has been any action there. Another point, there always will be action there. Another point, if I can't stop that one moving, I don't know what I'll do. Another point, there must be action there. Another point, there must be action there. Another point, there has to be action there. Another point, at least I have action there. Another point, I have action there. Another point, there will always be action there and I can't stop it. Another point, I must stop that point. I hope the point was completely motionless. Another point, I have to stop that point. This point is arrival. Another point, that's the source of all my trouble. Another point, that's coming in on me. Another point, that can't come in on me. Another point, that has to come in on me. All right, we've still got these points in assorted places, and I'll be sure you put one below and one above you. Okay, I'm supposed to be here. They think I'm there. I hope I am here. I'll never get there. They hope I'm here. Now, very rapidly, with all these assorted points around outside the body, well outside the body now. I'm supposed to be here? No, I'm supposed to be here. No, I think I'm here. No, I'm sure that's me. I'm certain that's doing it. That's causing it all. I'm supposed to be here. They don't know I'm here. They'll never find out I'm here. All is lost. Now another point, very precisely located point. All is lost. Another precisely located point. All is lost. And another one. All is lost. Another very precisely located point. All is lost. Another point located with signboards. All is lost. Another point, on the way. Another point, on the way. Another point, completely motionless. On the way. Another point, on the way. Another point, what a serious journey. Another point, I'm just a particle. Another point, all other particles are rivals. Another point, no letters better show up. Another point, if I resist enough, just that, if I resist enough. Another point, I don't think I'm here. Another point, I may be here. Another point, I'd better be judicious about where I am. Another point, it's important. Another point, it's important where I am. Another point, if this moved, they'd miss me. Another point, if this moved, they'd miss me. Another point, if this moved, they'd miss me. Another point, there is no motion. Another point, I need a stamp. Another point, I'm lost in the suit pocket. Another point, I have a mission. Another point, sitting completely still, I have a mission. Another point, I can't arrive here. Now another point, the security there, I can't be here. Another point, I'm just a particle. Another point, I'm just a particle. Another point, it takes consideration. Another point, I mustn't arrive here. I mustn't arrive here. Another point, I mustn't arrive here. Another point, this will never be there. Another point, here will never be there. Another point, I'm just a particle. Another point, I'm valuable because I'm a particle. I'm valuable because I'm a particle. I'm valuable because I'm scarce. I get a whole mass of points in one place where you haven't been putting them before. A whole mass of points. We're valuable because there's only one of us. Another one. Put a whole mass of points in another place where you haven't been putting points. We're not valuable because there's just one of us. Another point, I wonder where I'll get a seeing eye dog. Okay, now let's recall something real. Time when you were in good communication. Time when you felt some affinity. Time when you knew you'd never have any further affinity for anything. A time when you refused communication completely. A time when somebody else refused communication. Time that was completely unreal to you. See, one or two there just got time tracked. Time when you're in good communication. time when you wanted to be happy. Time when you decided you needed processing. Another time when you decided you needed processing. Another time when you decided you didn't need any further processing. You can make it just at the moment. Now something real. A time when you made somebody happy. Time when you had some suspicion that you weren't quite human. The time when you decided to play it in close so that you could get more sensation out of it. Something real. Good affinity. Good communication. Okay, for those who haven't been tracking easily on this, now let's remember present time. Okay, now let's get not being able to have present time. Now let's have present time. Okay, this morning we have to take up the matter of the communication particle. I gave you the little drill so that what I had to say is more understandable perhaps to some of you. And less restimulative, perchance, mayhap. Communication particle. The subject of Scientology in its highest echelon divides sharply, so far as this universe is concerned, into two immediate things. One is space. Its viewpoints and anchor points, definition of, use and exercises in, and the other, very closely allied to it, but of the same rank with it, because it goes into different forms elsewhere than this universe, is communication. Therefore, you should have a very good grasp of the theory of communication, because we have already seen that continuous agreement with this universe brought about a condition which was not always entirely desirable, at least from some viewpoints. I wish to make a cautious statement there because, of course, we're dealing with this universe. One has to be very cautious and impartial with regard to this universe. One mustn't go too fast. And the future is always the past in this universe. And the future is the particle that exploded and came your way but hasn't arrived yet, you see. So present time may be halfway on the line. See, there's been an explosion at this moment. Let us suppose there's been an explosion in South Jersey, the concussion waves of which will require 32 seconds to arrive. But it's a big explosion, will flatten the entire building. The explosion has happened. The buildings are not yet flat. Now, 15 seconds after the explosion, we have the explosion, the future of the building which is about to be flattened. Very simple. It's explosion is the future of the building, which is about to be flattened. But the explosion has already happened. It happened 15 seconds ago. But 15 seconds ago is the future of 17 seconds hence. Because that's obvious, because 17 seconds hence, that is, that's the future. That's 17 seconds from now. So that's 17 seconds into the future. So you see, the building will be flattened by an explosion, which is 32 seconds into the future of the explosion. But the flattened building is, at this point, 15 seconds after the explosion, 17 seconds in the future of the building. I hope you understand this. This is what's known as a communication lag. Now, where is present time? Where is present time? 15 seconds ago, there was an explosion, which 17 seconds into the future will flatten the place you're standing. Where's present time? Problems in velocities and relative motion have always been trying to the school child. As a matter of fact, they try the school child with them and try him and try him and try him. And then flunking before the high court if he doesn't succeed in being confused enough to answer this question, quote, intelligently, unquote. A boat is going down the river at 10 miles an hour. Another boat is coming up the river at 5 miles an hour. There is a current in the river of 5 miles an hour. At 3 o'clock, the upper boat started downriver, and at 3:02, the lower boat started upriver, and the 2 points are 36.872 miles apart. Exactly how far from the starting point of the first boat will the two boats pass? Very easy problem. The answer of it is, of course, a very simple answer. The answer, of course, is Miss Universe. And if you were simply to write this down in an examination paper, believe me, you'd be far more right than what they gave in the answer books. Because a mile is a distance which was composed of so many feet, and feet was the length between the heel and toe of a British king. See, and the miles near London are bigger than the miles out in the sticks. Very interesting. Miss Universe is the right answer. You want to know who measured the river? It could be very embarrassing as a school child. Who determined the velocity? How do we know that that's accurate? Now, this is a theoretical problem, I trust, because the method of progress of a river steamer is not measured in this type of velocity. So we must assume that you knew the answer before you figured out the problem so that you could get the average velocities. Therefore, it's a hypothetical problem and can't happen. Because it could only be determined by test and then figured backwards arithmetically. So it becomes a false problem which doesn't have any actual factors. Therefore, the problem's unsolvable. Simple. River steamer has to dart from the right bank to the left bank and go up with the current and so forth. A proper answer to it is that the velocity of the stream probably has no bearing upon it. The upbound river boat is probably being assisted by the eddies along the bank. Or we must go deeper into the problem and fire its pilot for being incompetent. In other words, people putting out this problem can get in very hot water. The only thing which really determines the answer to the problem, as any Thetan discovers, is experience. The only real answer to any problem is if the problem happens. Has it happened already? Well, then we know the answer to it. And Thetans who are in apathy about this whole cockeyed universe will get into that frame of mind eventually. They'll say, well, did it happen? Yes, it happened. Well, all right, if it happened, we know the answer to it. Just because it happened, though, is probably going to happen again, but we better not let it happen again, because if it happened in this universe, it's bad. There you go, Paul, adjudicate. We take up this explosion, this fascinating problem. Where is the 15 seconds? Is it in present time, or the past, or the future? Or just where is present time? The explosion happened, and then 32 seconds later the building flattened, and the person is at the building. Well, where is present time at the moment of the explosion? Well, present time could be the wavefront all the way on down toward the building, but then you have a present time 32 seconds long. I tell you, when you ask people in Dianetics to come to present time, you were asking them more than they rightly knew. So if it is so completely desirable to be in present time, it is logical to ask the simple, rather rhetorical question, where the hell is it? Time is determined by the relative motion of particles. That's all time is. In this universe, they move at a certain relative speed with regard to each other, and they will therefore traverse a certain proximity with regard to each other, according to your consideration. An old person very often finds the days going by like boxcars past a telephone pole, and a summer afternoon, when one is three, lasts forever. Consideration. We find two particles in proximity to each other, determining time. Who for?
Please note, at this point there was a break in the original master recording. This tape now resumes, as did the original master recording.
Second part of the October 30th morning lecture. Continuing on this particle with regard to time. Two particles, then, this is very elementary, two particles, two units of meshed universe are relatively spaced here and here, and then these two particles come together this speed, pass each other at this speed. Well, this simply means that there must have been some consideration concerning it. The second you say speed, there must be a consideration. Now, people go so daffy on this problem, they finally say, well, did any two particles cross at all? And if they did, right, let's just skip it. All is illusion, I can't see anything, I'm blind, let's not look. Because it's all illusion anyway, let's not look. Well, that's one way of looking at it, but here we have these two particles, they're passing each other, and somebody says they're traveling at the rate of 18 miles per hour. Well, that's fine, because you can set it up on messed universe. Look at the trap involved here. You can set it up on messed universe meters. And sure enough, it is traveling at 18 miles per hour. What do you know? Now we've proven it. What's 18 miles an hour? Well, 18 miles an hour can very easily be considered by a scientist as a datum which has some bearing on the subject. He thinks that if he reads it on a meter, he's made it come true. If you prove the meshed universe by the meshed universe, then the meshed universe is true. Follows. Now there's a particle there, and if there's a particle there, then there's a particle there. And he just moves right on past this very small and insignificant point. There's a particle there if there's a viewpoint. That's what proves that there's a particle there, not that there's a particle there. You see, 18 miles per hour is an automobile moving down the road according to its speedometer. It's being measured in its movement down the road by its speedometer. There was nobody to look. We're back into the old philosophic saw to some degree. Would there be a sound in the woods if there wasn't anybody in the woods? Well, let's solve it for a change. Put it into a category where we can use this thing instead of just squirreling on it. Now, the sound in the woods is a sound in the woods if we've determined there's a woods. That's about all there is to it. If we've determined there's a woods, we have to move it up another step. See, as long as they can keep it down to the basis of, is this car moving 18 miles an hour? Yes, it says 18 miles an hour on the speedometer, therefore it's moving 18 miles an hour. It's all simple and elementary. The second, if you move the same problem up into the fact, is there a sound in the woods if there is nobody in the woods to hear the sound in the woods? All right, there's two particles in the woods, and they're moving together. One is a tree, and the other is an air particle. And if these two come together, it signals the fact that the movement from the sound source has finally reached the tree. Now, isn't a problem, actually, of is there a woods? The most basic problem in it is the velocity, because we've immediately entered the field of consideration. We would consider it a great velocity from our viewpoint if it knocked down the tree. In other words, we've added volume or mass translation into speed. And that is the way we consider whether or not something is moving fast. The amount of creation or destruction performed thereby. Now, once or twice in Scientology, we have hazarded, what are these particles which compose this universe? We've talked about it quite a bit in this class. If you dehydrate mist in a certain way, in such a way, and on a certain system, otherwise it finally becomes very solid and viewable, and all is well. We do that. And if we throw some affinity at it, and too much affinity, why, it'll start to swell up and do other things. In other words, particles that obviously can be combined to do things with particles. If the same system of communication is applied to the particles which originated the particles, if the same system is applied, then, of course, you get the same behavior. Why? Well, you've agreed on the whole track, all the way on down the track, that that was the way it was going to happen. And if it was going to happen that way, then, of course, you've agreed that it's happening that way. And so they're there. There isn't any question about it not being there. They're there. There are particles. You have a viewpoint, don't you? Well, that's all it takes to make a particle. And the whole messed universe is proven by the fact that you have a viewpoint. It's proven by the fact that there's life, not by the fact that it measures itself. Now, the fixation upon the meter is wonderful. Because all a meter's doing is moving at the same ratio of the particles it's moving with, the particles it's measuring. It's of the same breed of cat and has been originated by the same agreement system, and it's running on exactly the same agreements as the particles it's measuring, particles or lack of. You see? You've taken a cat now and asked him whether or not there are cats. Of course, he's a cat, so he says there are cats. And here we have Q&A, because this universe is essentially foolishly silly in its origin. It is so simple in its origin that it would completely escape anything. As a matter of fact, a fellow can walk around a long time pondering this. What is the significance of it? Well, the reason he can work so long pondering it is because there isn't any significance to it. It's just the fact that a particle moving. Now, a person who is 60 or 70 sees a car go down the road at 25 miles an hour through traffic, and he says, speed demon. And the kid of 18 says, slow poke. Why don't you get off the road? Why don't you get it out of reverse, huh? Wake up and die right. Good point. Fact of the matter is that the only actual monitoring factor involved, the only metering factor on any of this, is consideration. We could get very biblical, religiousical, and logical, and say, Be ye as ye consider ye is.
No.
And you would have it. Be as you consider you are. And you would just about shape your personality. That is very fascinating because it merely says, it permits somebody to say that all you have to do is decide to be self-determined, you be self-determined from now on, that's all there is to it. So you mean that somebody comes along and says that. Fact of the matter is, that can't happen. I spent November 14th lecture of 1951, goes on for an hour saying how this is terribly possible, and then the second hour was devoted entirely to why it couldn't happen. An awful lot of people heard that first hour. Nobody ever listened to the second one. I should have reversed it. The point is that all art and so forth is agreement. It's basically agreement. So you get an art form out of an agreed upon aesthetic. But anybody can consider anything beautiful if he steps outside the field of agreement. There we have a clue to all of this. If you step outside the field of agreement far enough, you're outside of it, believe me. And there's where exteriorization and its results produces your sudden effects. And why you can then go on and exercise somebody into what? The creation and destruction of particles. Creation and destruction of space. Creation and destruction of communications and channels. While exteriorized. Because he doesn't have to agree with speed. Now, while a person is being audited, he has to some degree, agree with the speed of the auditor. But that's all right. We can get up to a higher speed than is normally tolerable in communication lines, and you're outside the agreement level. Or we could actually go down to a slower speed than is normally tolerable, and we're outside the communication agreement speed. Because we have to step outside of the speed agreement. And this is only stepping outside of the agreement that there must be motion. That's one of the first agreements. The thing that pins people in this universe is just that, there must be or there must not be motion. The one thing that is peculiar in this universe is this fact, motion. Why should there be motion? That's very silly. Motion says that you have to go from one place to another place in a gradient line of travel. You have to go from, when you go from A to B, this universe tries to tell you, when you go from A to B, you have to go to A plus micromillimeter, A plus micromillimeter, A plus micromillimeter. See? Down to the halfway point when they would start calling it B minus maximum micromillimeters, less one until you're B. The way to go from A to B is to go B. The way to go from the center of town to the edge of town is block by block. Well, every time you do that, you are, in effect, creating new spaces. Now, we're not quite sure what we have to do with these old spaces that have been created, but we're no longer there. So it's all right. We've kept creating space, so we just say that's all in the past. That's vanished space. All Thetan has to do is lose his ability to vanish space. And he's stuck with the past and present time. It's just as simple as that. The second he loses his ability to vanish space, he's stuck with the past and present time. Which hangs him up with what? That hangs him up exclusively with because he can't get any more space. Because where he is now doesn't matter. It doesn't make more space. See? The fact that he's at 9th and Chester doesn't make new space because the space he made that morning was at 5th and Wesson when Joe hit him in the rear end. with another car. That's space. So he has to be convinced over and over and over, more and more and more and more and more, to make a new point of space. And the first fellow goes along simply by creating and destroying particles. He's got lots of new space, new space, new space, new space, new space. And then after a while, he loses his ability to do that on that scale, so he starts borrowing particles to that somebody else is sort of moving along for him. And the next thing you know, why, he's down into a level where he's got to, where he's what going what? He's going n-gram to n-gram to n-gram to n-gram. That's his space particles. He's making new space on the basis of, let's see, I was hit in the jaw in Milwaukee. That gave me an anchor point. Masses of anchor points is what he has to have. He's got to be convinced he made one. But just the fact of driving by Fifth and Elm doesn't, at that instant, give him the space of Fifth and Elm. If it did, he'd be in present time. What determines the ability to be in present time? Simply that. Then what determines a communication? A communication, in essence, would be flowing along a certain line, making gradients of new space by this universe definition. And that is the imposition of an arbitrary. So your theta recovers quite rapidly if he does his communication on a change of space basis, A to B, A to B, A to B, A to B, A to B. Okay? But if it's A plus 1 micrometer, so on, he sort of loses out. He has to be perfectly willing to let such thing as a body go on doing all the gradient steps of a communication line while he himself is content to guide it, or to guide other particles, or to reform or mass or take apart other particles. If he's just willing to do that, he's all right. He can go through all the gradient steps he wants to. Then one day he says, I am a particle. He begins to believe that the particles which compose this stuff up here are alive. The day he gets interested in little things which are alive, just like he is, reference biology class, he's gotten the idea that particles are alive, and that particles recombining with particles is life itself. And this is the doctrine which is taught today. There's this universe, see, and after a while there gets to be a crystalline formation. And this crystalline formation, see, and here we go. I mean, we're off toward madness immediately. Because we have taken out of the problem the one factor which solves the problem. Consideration. We have fixed him with the arbitrary of having to consider himself as a particle and consider life as produced by particles and giving to particles, as in that wall, those molecules, the role of source. He doesn't want to do that, so he assigns to those particles in the wall the role of receipt point. And when he assigns that role to them, he's doing what they were supposed to do in the first place. But if he's identified himself with a particle, he thinks he's going to wind up eventually as a molecule. And all I had to do earlier on the track was to implant somebody with an implant known as the electron, and we're all set with a universe, and everybody could be slaves. And that's all it took. And you find a lot of preachers going around. They're afraid they're going to become messed. There are implants all over the place that tell them they should become messed. So forth. You'll never be one of those particles. You can't be. You can have them. You can have all you want of them. You can make all you want of them. But you don't dare destroy that stuff eventually because it's alive. You don't dare destroy it. It's alive. It is. It's terrible. You don't believe that, watch some mama sometime upbraiding the little kid for having wrecked one of his toys. She gives him the definite idea the toy must be alive and hurt. And people will talk in terms of hurting messed objects.
This lecture is continued on side 2 of this cassette.
They talk of themselves as being ruined, and the rain is ruining their hat. You see? They talk of a motor having been abused, but they hope it didn't hurt it. They hope running it without oil for the last 20 miles didn't hurt it any. Complete confusion. They're messed. And as long as they believe this, they think they're going to go on a dwindling spiral straight down to the point where they become one of them. And I let this coast for a long time to see how it wound up and what it did with cases and so forth. One time, I just let it slide. And I mentioned in a lecture that there was some feeling that this might not be, this might be so. And we got an immediate opinion by a lot of auditors. Yes, sir. What molecules were dead things. Yeah, molecules are dead things. And so people suppose this to be true. They see a body lie down and die. And then they see it become dust. Obviously the person was dust then. Elementary, simple, neat. Of course, they don't want anybody to know that the second thing started to kick the bucket, they shoved off. Anything that was alive there and could consider was gone. So we have life as the thing which can consider. One of its higher activities is consideration. If it can broadly and certainly consider something aesthetic, it can do so. Actually, a little kid running the glorious irresponsibility of being a baby can consider that a lot of the darndest things are beautiful. Ooh. They come around, and just any mess is perfectly all right. Any form they put it into, any way they smash it up, it's still beautiful. It's considered so. And then one day, some artist in the rough goes to art school. The next thing you know, Van Gogh, he's considering, all right, but he's considering with a messed communication lag. And that is the death of an artist. This stuff is not supposed to be destructible. The postulate with which it's made is it does not destroy itself. That's the postulate in it. And if a fellow thinks he's messed and just another breed of particle and some kind of a communication system of particles which somehow mysteriously and mystically have become alive in some fashion or another, he thinks that he will get conservation of energy on this thing. Well, he knows he can do it because he's made out of these particles, and these particles say they must destroy each other. The last ditch in this, as far as politics is concerned, is communism. We mustn't destroy each other. We can't. We must conserve everything. We must produce, and we sort of live parasitically off anything that'll move. That's sort of a weird idea. Justice is composed of we mustn't destroy each other. And a Thetan should be able to pull stuff apart and put it back together again rather easily. Because if he doesn't, the stuff will pile up on him in the present. The energy he's using is energy, if he's fool enough to use energy. Now, you just run on somebody with these considerations, the idea of I am a particle, and you get dynamite. You get mock up a communication line going through his head or something of the sort and have him be on one end of it, then be on the other end of it. I'm source. I'm receipt point. Weird things will happen to his case. Weird. He gets somatics all over the place. Not particularly a bad process, but doesn't lead too far. But quite often will unburden the case markedly, a case that thinks it has to think. The thing you should do with such a case is merely rehabilitate his ability to create and uncreate space. And you notice we haven't gone too much yet into the uncreation of space exercises. fellow, after a while, gets scared to create something, you see, because if he creates the damn thing, it'll still stay around and he can't get rid of it. If most artists, if you who are deteriorating, you ask them suddenly why they're not painting as many pictures as they used to, they would tell you bluntly, well, I mean, it's their first response, if you could only get it on a flash answer, it would be, well, I'd have them around. But it's completely unconsidered. They have other methods of getting rid of them. They sell them. They translate them into other kinds of anchor points. Money, which vanishes very quickly. A writer almost never can be persuaded to write 5 or 6 stories in advance of the one he has a sale for. He'd have them around, you see? In other words, his method of destroying a thing he created is to sell it. Get rid of it. Now you have amongst the communist art schools the theory that one should never sell anything or part with it. Naturally. At least commercial art permits one to get it gone. You know, swoosh. He gets the idea after a while, though, that it's precious and ought to endure someplace or another. That is a lower echelon, lower level idea. Well, all right, we needn't beat this thing to death. It becomes very simple that an individual who supposes himself to be an anchor point is not going to be able to make space. And an individual who supposes himself to be a communication particle, which is merely a kind of anchor point, cannot, of course, make communications or receive them. Now, what's a motivator? What's an overt act? How's that tie into this? Simply, the motivator overt act sequence is a great deal of trouble for cases. As a matter of fact, is the hang up of the maybe. And if you want to know why is it the hang up of the maybe, it's because a person has tangled his consideration with the consideration of being a particle to a point where he has to have facsimiles with which to operate. He is a particle, he can only operate with particles, so therefore, only being able to operate with particles, it is then obvious that he has to have a particle before he can put the particle into action. A person has already abandoned his ability to create and destroy particles for this lifetime. You know, he's saying, I've been punished enough. I can't create and destroy particles. I didn't do it. I can't make it. He's gotten the idea that he has to receive a facsimile before he can use it in an action. And if he's done something, you see, without the facsimile, then he's gone against the law of something or other. He's gone against the law of the mesh universes. There has to be a particle, it says too, there has to be a particle there before there can be any motion of a particle. It's a silly law, but I mean, it's the fundamental law. It sounds too simplified, but it's there. There has to be a particle there before there is a particle. In other words, nobody made these particles. These particles are not being manufactured at this moment. And they are, you see. People believe this, we're low on intelligence, and they believe nothing is being manufactured at this moment in terms of a new particle. They think they are already manufactured by God or something at some unimaginable distance in the past, when the stuff is just floating around, changing its positions, so, and vanishing with relationship to other particles. All right, the effort to arrive is the effort to have motivators. One gets the idea when he goes along the line that if he can just have enough things happen to him, then he'll have enough particles and enough impacts so that he will then have enough fuel or energy with which to arrive at a point toward which he's going. And these impacts and so forth might even work in such a fashion as to drive him along this line to make him arrive at B. He sort of thinks he has to be beaten into it, in other words, because he knows he hasn't got energy enough to go the rest of the gradient scale to B. Now, the efforts to have motivators is also the effort to be the source. See? I mean, a fellow. Before he can be source of any output of energy, why, he has to have some energy to use as to output. Same law as we just went over with regard to the mesh universe. There has to be a particle there before there is a particle. So as a motivator, he has to have motivators before he can be source. Therefore, you get all wise men and messiahs and things of this character, having to be beaten into complete apathy, and crowns of thorns and sacrifice and all of this sort of thing has to go along before they, quote, have the authority to be a messiah, unquote. See, it takes a lot of motivators. Well, this comes about through actually the belief that one needs facsimiles in order to use facsimiles. Of course, if one uses facsimiles, one needs facsimiles. One needs facsimiles, one uses facsimiles. It's obvious. Now, the dependence upon facsimiles is therefore merely a dependence upon already created particles, which is already an abandonment of the ability to create particles. And that ability to create particles is abandoned when a person first begins to believe that he can't destroy particles. He can't out-postulate somebody. You're dead. No, I'm not dead. Yes, you are dead. He can't out-postulate somebody. Now, the thirst for motivators equals the necessity to have and use facsimiles. Anybody who has motivator hunger is using facsimiles for operation, fuel, energy. They will also eat other people's facsimiles. They will steal facsimiles. They go out of valence to have it explained well why they're in Joe's valence. They're in Joe's valence because Joe is a very put-upon man and he's very sad, so that means he has lots of facsimiles, so he just pick up those facsimiles and use them for fuel. And he's got lots of motivation for doing something, so therefore he theoretically could be source. If I just had Joe's woe, I could be source. That's the way it works out. Now this is, you notice then, anybody who is having motivator hunger, you can run just so long in this case, and all of a sudden you have to give the case a whole flock of motivators. Well, although we've been letting this go by this far because we didn't want to stretch this material, the wrong way to run it is feed the motivators. Wrong way to run it. Nonsense. They mock up motivators, mock up motivators, mock up motivators. They might as well be mocking up energy. I mean, this is silly. It's adding too much reason to processing. You don't have to have mock up motivators. Rehabilitate. This is remedied by the rehabilitation of the ability to create. Create what? Energy. Which is remedied by, to some degree, the sudden realization the fellow can destroy something or make it invisible or do anything with it. He'd make it vanish. If you worked with a PC until he got something vanished, why, he'd be much happier, and after that he'd be able to create better. So you'd work with him some more until he made something vanish, either by making it invisible or doing anything you want to it. You see, he don't care what you do. Why, you'd get around to, after a while, the point where his creative urge would come way on up. He has to be able to destroy before he can first create. And there are some slugs that have kind of crawled into the universe through back doors, in the fated world, who are going around so dazed on this one that they try to destroy everybody and everything they run into in an effort, to then be able to rehabilitate their ability to destroy. And if they can destroy enough, then they'll have the right to create again. This is highly, highly simple. It isn't an ethical question. Motivators, overt acts, are not a question which belongs in morality or ethics. And any time you tangle it with morality or ethics, you're simply letting your preclear agree some more with a system which won't put him up into the line of being an artist again or being able to make space again or anything else. Morality is itself an interesting thing because it's a nice game. It's a game of restraint and restriction. When it gets played down to the level of making somebody a slave, that's playing the game a little bit too far, and a fellow looks up and he can't quite see that it's a game anymore. Well, then how do you rehabilitate somebody who's motivator hungry? Well, how do you rehabilitate somebody who just goes around trying to destroy everything? He just wants to destroy. That has, by the way, it's very overt, this destruction. They're not looking for a back of the hill significance to this. They may talk about constructing something, but the truth of the matter is they're not putting anything out. They're just overtly destroying. So you can go out and look at their mast. Very good test. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. End mist. We go and look at this, and we look at that, and with regard to their actions. Auditors, people in Scientology, actually, in Dianetics, by and large, are darn nice people. As I noticed yesterday when I said, worthwhile people haven't time. A couple of guys in the class winced. Well, the point is, we do have a leisure class. People who have some slight margin on their ability. There you're picking up the top crust of the society. The working, upper working class intellectual of the society is more pinned down. You can determine a person's worthwhileness to a large degree by the pinned downness until we go into the mockery level of the scale, and then we find somebody is entirely mobile just so he'll destroy, destroy, destroy. See how you work that out? You get the most mobile straight out of the society. The most mobile, and when we say mobile, we just mean comfortably able to move about. In the society, ordinarily, it's most worthwhile straight out of the society. People can create things. They can destroy things. They're taking it fairly comfortable, fairly easy on life. Below that level, we have professional levels, and these people are less mobile, but they're not immobile. And we go down below that, we find the working stiff, the fellow who works hard. That's the phrase with which he calls himself, not the phrase I call him. And he works less hard than the laborer, but he's pretty well pinned down. His margins of survival are not very great. Then we get into the labor, and the worst margin of society you ever saw in your life is the fellow who has to sweat the hardest in order to eat. And we get down to that level. Now we start to drop into the loony bin. Because down below the level of a person's ability to work, we start to run into neurosis and psychosis. And we find people that are flying all over the place. They're never still a moment. They never go home. They never do this. They don't got one. If they do have one, why, it's a mess and a hurrah. And they'll only stay with that long enough to completely bust it skywide and handsome. And you get this tremendous commotion going on. These people, by the way, rarely have any substance. They rarely have any mess to amount to anything. They rarely have any, in this society, rarely have any money. They rarely have anything. Fascinating how that package goes together. I've only had about 3 years of looking at man, and it's quite interesting how his categories fall together so easily. The town drunk, for instance, he's into an inversion of an inversion stage. You see, he's not only broke, indigent, and neurotic, he also now is in the next stage down where he makes himself unconsciously. Well, the reason he doesn't move around is he's not there, and he's not anywhere. See how your society straight up falls apart. Actually, there are only 10 or 15,000 intellectuals in America, people who are free, people who have some mobility. You would be utterly amazed, people of this class, and the people you associate with and so forth. You'd be utterly confused to know. I mean, it would be amazing to you. If you just took a look and found out how few you were, numerically, in this nation, 10 or 15,000. About the works. I mean, you go around and you get confounded because everybody's supposed to be equal in America. You go around and you get utterly confounded because the fellow next door just can't seem to understand what you're talking about. He knows you're a very clever fellow, very witty, kind of nutty sometimes about some things and so forth. But he doesn't understand you. Well, the reason he doesn't understand you is his breadth of understanding isn't very worth to it. He's in a pattern. You've never inspected this fellow for a pattern. He puts on his hat at a certain moment. He goes through certain moments. The job he's doing very often looks like it's a very intelligent job and that sort of thing. But if you worked hard, you could dream up a robot that would do the same job. This isn't decrying such an individual. This is probably below the level of the professional. A professional, the professional class of the country, used to include its doctors. These fellows are just working stiffs now. They're penicillin needle pushers. They're technicians. Always you read in costume historicals or diaries or something like that. The doctor was always hanging around the drawing room and they were this and that and so forth. Philosophic discussion of this or that was going on. Why, his opinion was always on it. Well, don't ask a modern doctor his philosophic discussion opinion. The last discussion I entered into with a U.S. doctor on the subject was, he came in to give me a shot. I had a, I had everything, God's green earth, fall on my head for a few days, and it had been very wet, and I'd gotten cold a couple of times. So I decided that I'd just better stop what little bacterial fuss that was going on in my lungs with a shot of penicillin, so I had somebody send for a doctor. He noticed my name on a grip. He didn't say a thing. He merely got very brutal. What do you want to go into philosophy for and that stuff? Here we go, Miss Universe. He's very interesting, very interesting. And I noticed he had a rash, a bit of a rash below his ear when he left. I hadn't said a word to him. So, by the way, Doc, if you, though they hate to have you call him Doc, because a Doc is something that belongs to a horse, or it's something you tie a boat to. And as he left, I said, by the way, Doc, if you want to get rid of that rash, come around and see me sometime. There are some of the old boys still around who haven't been super indoctrinated, but they're real old, by the way. They're real nice guys. Okay. That's not off the point, particularly. It's just a consideration. But it's also the ability to create. The ability to create, unfortunately, depends, as you would neglect, if you need processing, if you really need processing, it's merely because you have neglected the ability to destroy. And this doesn't ask for people to go out in mass armies and blow down all the towns. That is a method of trying to waste the ability to destroy on the mass universe itself. Where the ability to destroy must be put into place is the fellow's ability to blow up his own facsimiles. Stop using facsimiles for anchor points. Now, a process immediately presents itself. If you can just get a PC to start using just that, facsimiles, indestructible facsimiles as anchor points, and keeping putting them up, brackets of six, and then run five on the next universe, then a bracket of six, of indestructible anchor points. He'll run out the postulate and the anger that he went into one day when some other thing kept pot shooting him all the time. He put up an anchor point, some other thing come along, blow him in, put up some more, blow him in, put up some more, blow him in. This was a good game, only up to a point where he says, here I go now. And he puts up these indestructible anchor points. And you know he's still got them? You'll find them in the case. Indestructible. I'm going to hold this line if it's the last thing I ever do. But of course, he recognized at that point that he has been chosen for somebody else's randomity. So other determinism ensues. And the second he does that, he begins to associate himself with particles to some slight degree, and after that goes into the line of being a particle, and the second he becomes a particle, he starts believing he's a communication. Now, get this. The Thetan, 3 feet, 12 feet, 8 miles, 6 light years, back of the head. And using the body for a communications unit, a relay point for what he's thinking, is doing something entirely different than a Thetan who is in the body, being a communications relay point. You want to know what's the chief difference between an exteriorized Thetan and an interiorized?